Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I am Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program tonight is, What Do Midterm Elections Mean for the Environment in California and the Nation? Our speakers are Michael Mantell, President, Resources Legal Fund, Mary Kriesman, Chief Executive Officer, California League of Conservation, and Michael Sutton, Executive Director, Goldman Environmental Foundation, who will be our moderator. Please welcome them. And Michael, I'll turn it over to you as our moderator.
Thank you so much, Ann, and thank you all for being here tonight. 1 week away from what could be a historic election, we are very fortunate to have with us tonight two very knowledgeable and politically savvy panelists. Michael Mantell on the far left is the president of the Resources Legacy Fund in Sacramento, former Undersecretary of Natural Resources here in California, and a very experienced political hand, particularly here in California. For example, he successfully defended California's landmark climate law from attacks a few years ago and has engineered the enactment of something like $10 billion worth of bond money over the years for conservation. So Michael knows his way around the politics of California and the nation. Mary Kriesman, on my immediate left, is recently appointed Executive Director of the California League of Conservation Voters, formerly of the Trust for Public Lands, also a very savvy politico. She helped lead the Prop 64 campaign this summer that resulted in more money for conservation on the June ballot. Let me just start our conversation this afternoon or this evening by setting the stage for our discussion a little bit at what's at stake in this election for the environment. All over the country, 1 week from today, we'll be electing governors, members of Congress, we'll be voting on ballot measures and local elections. According to Mary's colleagues at the League of Conservation Voters, this is the most important election in our lifetimes. It's also the most expensive midterm election in our lifetimes. The Center for Responsive Politics says we are on track to spend upwards of $5 billion nationwide by next week. So think about that for a minute. Now, what's in play in this election? It's a midterm election, as you all know. Up for election are no fewer than 36 governors, 470 members of Congress. That includes all 435 seats in the House of Representatives, 35 seats in the Senate. As you know, there are 100 senators, but the elections are staggered. So there are 35 Senate seats up for election. Now, as you probably also know, the Republicans control both houses of Congress now. In the House of Representatives, Republicans hold 237 seats, Democrats hold 193, and there are five vacancies. So Republicans have a 19-seat majority. In the Senate, Republicans have a much thinner majority, hold 51 of 100 seats. So the election potentially, at least, puts both houses of Congress in play. Historically, the president's party tends to lose seats during the midterm elections. It's held true for many years. But will there be a blue wave that will usher in Democratic control of one or both houses of Congress? That's one of the questions that our panelists will be addressing tonight. Many believe that there will be, based on a combination of factors, including the results of recent polling and the performance of candidates in special elections. Voter turnout next week is probably going to be much higher than usual in a midterm election. According to the Pew Research Center, quote, voter enthusiasm is at its highest level during any midterm election in more than two decades, unquote. As evidence of that, turnouts in the polls surged during primary elections across 31 states this year. Latest reports indicate that early voting, which of course has already started in many states, is also far ahead of normal. And significantly, a record 257 women are running for the House and Senate this fall, and 235 women won House primaries this year. That is more than at any year in the nation's history. But there you are.
That deserves a woo.
Let me just go over what's at stake in each House, and then we're going to turn it over to the panel. In the House of Representatives, all 435 members up for re-election, about two-thirds of the races are what you would consider safe seats, where the incumbent is likely to win. That leaves about 100 districts where there will be competitive races for one degree or another. And of those, about 30 look like they're genuine coin tosses. Most of those seats are held by Republicans. So to win control of the House, the Democrats would need to pick up 23 seats minimum in this election, which, of course, is well within the realm of possibility in a midterm election. While there's no certainty here, many believe that it's very likely the Democrats will regain control of the House, picking up anywhere from 20 to 40 seats in the House. In the Senate, however, Democrats have a tougher, much tougher odds of winning control. That's because the electoral math favors Republicans. Remember that senators' terms are staggered. Democrats hold 26 and Republicans hold only 9 of the seats of the 35 seats that are up for election. So to win control of the Senate, Democrats would have to hold on to every one of those seats and flip 2 Republican seats blue. So at least 10 seats, though, of those seats controlled by Democrats are in states that were carried by President Trump in 2016. So that's a much tougher lift than the House for the Democratic Party. At the state level here in California, we'll be voting for a new governor, as you know, one of our two senators, and all 53 members of the House of Representatives, the most of any state. California will also be voting a number of significant ballot measures. Many of you probably already have voted on those ballot measures, with implications for the environment, including Proposition 3, a wetlands and water ballot measure, provides significant funding for water projects and wetlands conservation. And don't forget that local ballot measures such as Proposition A right here in San Francisco, which would authorize the rebuilding of the seawall along the Embarcadero, means we don't have to wear waders when we come to a Commonwealth Club reception. So what are the implications of all this for the environment? That's the question for the panel. I've asked the panelists to address a couple of questions. First of all, what happens if Republicans retain control of both houses of Congress? That's a possible outcome next week. Will they interpret that as a vote of confidence in their current agenda and carry on, double down? Second, what happens if, as seems likely, the Democrats regain control of one house, probably the House of Representatives? For example, will we see them attempt to exercise greater oversight over the work of the Trump administration and the executive agencies? Just this week, I read that up to 6 cabinet officials may submit their resignations after the midterm elections. So what will happen there? What happens in the unlikely event that Democrats take control of both houses of Congress? That's another possibility. And finally, what are the implications for the environment of the election right here in California? If Gavin Newsom is elected governor, what can we expect to see in terms of environmental action? Will he want to continue some of Governor Brown's initiatives, like the twin tunnels under the Delta? Are those likely to be built? If John Cox is our next governor, how will he treat the environment? And these are all questions that the panelists have agreed to address. So let's start with Mary Kreisman.
You want me to address all of those? Oh, sorry. All of those at once, or take the first part?
Go ahead.
Okay, I'm going to take the first part. That's a lot. We'll go back and forth over here. First, I just want to say it's wonderful to be at the Commonwealth Club. It's been such an institution for thought leadership, for important conversations like this one. And so it's great to be here. And I am going to talk a little bit about what we can expect in a couple different scenarios nationally. But first, what I'm actually a little bit more interested in is what we're all going to do. How many folks believe that this is really a defining election cycle for our country? Great. Seems like we have some consensus there. How many folks have contributed to a race this cycle? How many folks have volunteered for a campaign this cycle? Okay. Still some work to do, and we still have time. A little bit of a joke, but actually very, very seriously, we are in the place we are in because of a history of really having a broken system. And that's why I'm here. We have a system that historically has been designed to not work for everybody. And so we have a system that really doesn't. And I would say really a democracy that's in a state of emergency. There was a lot of press around our primary in the spring. We got 37% turnout, and that was hailed as huge turnout for a primary election, the best we've seen in two decades. Typically, it's around 25%. When we have 25% of the folks who are eligible to vote who are turning out for an election cycle, that is a crisis of our democracy. That's a state of emergency. And that's part of the reason that we have such a struggle to really move forward policies and initiatives that are right for our state, both in terms of the environment and in terms of equity. I would really say that I think part of the reason I'm starting by talking about I'm most interested in what we do, because next Tuesday is our test, especially in California. We've had over the last 2 years a lot of, you know, quote unquote, resistance, a wave of activism, a wave of marches, a wave of social media outrage. Those will not turn into the political power we need to actually have an answer for what's happening right now unless those turn into votes. And we have a week left to see if that will happen. And I think specifically for California, this is a test. And the reason why this is a test in California more than other states is that we do not have the same attacks on voting rights that other states are facing right now. We do not have the same barriers in terms of gerrymandering of our districts that other states are facing right now. We actually have resources, political will, energy, and force in terms of the direction that we want to take the country that other states don't have. And yet we also have some of the most critical congressional seats in the country in our state. So if we are not really able to be that front edge of the blue wave next Tuesday, that is going to say a lot about our country's ability to make the change we need to say at all and turn around the state of the country. And I think that's really important. We have we've seen in California a lot of movement towards more independent, more folks registering as independent. We have these seats in which throughout Southern California and some in Northern California that are a toss-up, both in unseating incumbents and in flipping some districts to be more environmentally friendly. And what I would say is I think based on what happens in some of these districts, we will know how much we're in our own bubble, whether our messaging is resonating and will resonate nationwide if we can do it in our own districts, or whether or not we're in a place that we don't even have the resources or the manpower to actually turn our own state's districts blue. And I say blue because this is not about Republican Democrat. Right now we have the leading formal Republican Party that is waging attacks on our environment. So that's what this conversation is about, is our environment, and that's what we've seen. And so I think we can talk about what's going to happen after November 6th. There's worst case scenarios, there's best case scenarios from a national perspective. But I think what's so important right now is that we have a week left to go. And if we are not doing everything that we think we can be doing, it is not enough. And that's what's at stake. So worst case scenario, best case scenario for November 6th. Worst case scenario, we don't pick up the House or the Senate. And then the Republicans have a true mandate for the direction they've been going. President Trump has a mandate to double down. And it won't just be his spin, his lying. It'll be literally we handed a mandate. Best case scenario, we pick up the House and the Senate. And in that scenario, it's still a tough road. But what we have an opportunity to do is we have an opportunity to use the Senate and the House to really start to put Trump and his administration on the defensive, to do some offensive work on what needs to be done and try to flip the momentum and put them on the defensive. The other thing we have a chance to do is try to impact the changes that the administration is making through the budget process, through the purse strings. What is going to happen regardless is we know the work that's going to be done through the Trump administration, through the EPA and other agencies that are responsible for protecting our environment and are doing the opposite. We also know, that is a danger regardless of what happens after November 6th, and it's going to continue. The other thing we know is that we have a Supreme Court that will absolutely be the defense force for the Trump administration. No question. The good news is we have a lot of state Supreme Courts that are turning very progressive, which is important. And I think we'll see that making a difference in terms of some of the state actions. But for anything that has federal implications, that can go to the Supreme Court, even if we try to use litigation to stop some of the actions of the Trump administration. And that's going to be tough. So I would say this, just to close out the first part of the conversation around federally what's happening. is that I think more than ever, what Trump has taught us is that who is in office matters very deeply, right? And there are, I think in the environmental community, we have a history of being kind of squirmy around politics and electoral politics, feeling like, that's kind of the ugly part of the stuff I'm not as interested in. And I was talking with somebody earlier, I think also in the foundation community and a lot of the broader environmental NGO community, much more comfortable weighing in, investing in, and supporting and thinking about policy changes than electoral change. And we are at a moment where that has cost us. And we've absolutely got to get everybody off the bench. Whether or not you're comfortable with it or not, we can't afford to be uncomfortable with it. It's the truth of how policy and how power is distributed in our state and in our country. And we need everybody off the bench because who in office really does matter.
So elections matter. Thank you, Mary. Michael?
Thank you. It's a privilege to be here, and thank you all for taking the time. I have to start out with a little context. I'm really loathe after what happened in November of 2016 to make any predictions, because not only was I wrong, but every so-called expert that I looked at and every poll that I looked at was wrong about the outcome there. So I will talk about scenarios, but there are likely to be many other events that are unforeseen right now that are going to intervene that will have far more impact on where policies go than any prognostication that I may make. And I want to plant one other seed with you, which is the longer term, before I talk about some scenarios. And that is that somehow, from the bottoms up, we need to re-engage and foster Republican leadership on these issues. It's just a tragedy that one whole political party now has moved away from these issues, not only moved away, but actually is hostile. And, you know, I'm fortunate enough to have grown up professionally at a time when a lot of leadership actually on these issues came from Republicans. I actually was mentored in many ways by two leading Republicans, Russell Train, who was the first head of the Council on Environmental Quality under President Nixon, and Bill Riley, who was at that time head of the World Wildlife Fund when Mike Sutton was there as well, but became the EPA administrator under Bush 1. And these were two really visionaries, leaders, committed conservationists. Similarly, I grew up at a time in Washington, D.C., where there was a lot of bipartisan consensus on these issues, and frankly, leadership coming as much from the Republican side as from the Democratic side, from people like Senator John Chafee of Rhode Island, Sherwood Bullard, representative from New York, Ralph Regula, congressman from Ohio on appropriations issues particularly. Some really great people made some important things happen on the Republican side of the aisle. And there weren't arguments. There were regular arguments, but they were largely over the means, not the ends. And the Republicans had a really interesting philosophy on means. I mean, Bill Riley pioneered with the Bush administration, actually, you know, a form of cap and trade under the revisions to the Clean Air Act having to do with acid rain in 1990. And then I actually took a job with Pete Wilson as governor's undersecretary for resources, in large part, and I was an independent at the time, because of his environmental platform, strong opposition to offshore drilling, worked closely with then-Governor Wilson and then-Congressman Leon Panetta on the proposal that resulted in the largest boundaries for the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary that was approved by Congress, cutting-edge habitat conservation planning that Governor Wilson led, really innovative water policy development in collaboration with the Clinton administration, creating a CalFed program for the Bay Delta and for the future management of California's water, and a lot of interesting innovations on land use planning. And similarly, had the privilege of working with the Schwarzenegger administration on a lot of things, in which Mike Sutton was head of the Fish and Game Commission for many years, including, you know, as Mike said, the creation of the largest network of marine protected areas in the country, the creation of the Ocean Protection Council, support of Prop 84 at the time, a $7 billion natural resources bond that had a lot of money for habitat conservation, for parks, for oceans. Obviously, Schwarzenegger worked very closely with Fran Pavley and the legislature, created what became AB 32, California's pioneering climate change law, which Governor Brown has certainly taken to a whole nother level, but it was really pioneered by a Republican administration. did an incredible deal on the most largest single landholding left in California, Tejon Ranch, where 90% of it was preserved, using some of the public money. So I think it's important to remember that and to find ways to reengage at the bottoms up level, the grassroots level, so that it's just not acceptable for Republican elected office holders to be so hostile to these issues and actually be creative and innovative and problem solvers on these issues.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is What Do Midterm Elections Mean for the Environment in California and the Nation? Right now, you're listening to Michael Mantell, President of Resources Legal Fund. And we just heard from Mary Kreisman, Chief Executive Officer, California League of Conservation. Michael Sutton is our Executive Director of the Goldman Environment Foundation, our moderator. So, Michael, we come back to you, and we look forward to your comments now. Thank you.
Thank you, Ann. So, turning to scenarios, I'll track a little with Mary saying on the federal side, and then start the conversation on the state side. So, you know, first of all, at the federal side, we have to all understand, and Mary alluded to this, the executive branch has enormous discretion over a lot of issues. So whatever happens in Congress is very important, but still we have a president and administration that is of a very different mindset on these issues. And in California, almost 50% of California is owned and managed by the federal government. They have the largest water project in the country is federally operated, the Central Valley Project. So they have a lot of say over water resources in the state. The Forest Service has 20% of the land. That's mostly in the Sierra Nevada. That's where all 67%, two-thirds of California water comes from the Sierra Nevada. Obviously a focal point for wildfires. The California desert is largely owned and managed by the Bureau of Land Management. 20 million acres in the California desert is federally owned, and a lot of renewable energy development, a lot of mining, a lot of issues come to a head. Obviously, important habitat protection come to the head in the California desert. So, and we've seen where the administrations want to go on these issues, including recently as last week, Trump made pronouncements about water. In California, previously he made a point about the problems in California related to wildfire are a result that we let too much water go into the Pacific Ocean. But the reality is that because of what's happened under state and federal law, but also because of agreements that have been reached, the state and federal water systems are managed jointly in the same facility with the federal operators of the Central Valley Project sitting right beside the state operators. And under law, the first flows that will happen probably sometime within a month, certainly by the end of the year from a major rainstorm, those first flows go to fish. They go to the environment. There's nothing that Trump, if the Trump administration tries to play with that, they'll be in court the next day. And but after that, I do think it's important to recognize how much discretion is left to the executive branch to administer these laws. But if the Senate and the House stay the same, I think it's fair to say, and I think Mary alluded to this, that they will be unleashed because they don't have another election to deal with until 2020. And there's just a lot that are on their plate to do, largely in the energy, I think, area in terms of oil and gas development, fracking, and water system overhaul. And I think Congress will be, and how management of our public lands, our parks, our wildlife areas, our national forests, our national conservation areas. And I think that the Congress and the administration will be determined to jam as much through as they possibly can regarding those resources. A key, I think, factor will be how large will the majority be in the Senate. And I say this because ultimately the Senate is the body that makes judicial appointments. They're obviously determined to get as many through as they possibly can, as quickly as they can. But the reality is that a lot of the changes that the Trump administration has tried to make administratively in the energy space, in the clean air space, in the public land space, has so far been held up by the judiciary as not being, they have not followed procedures, they have not followed laws, they have not provided adequate opportunities for public comment a lot of procedural issues, but a lot of those things are right now tied up in the courts and having to be redone. That's not to say they haven't made progress on fracking on Western lands and even lease sales, though. They haven't. They've had some major lease sales on federal lands throughout the West. A lot of those have not been bidded on. But nonetheless, the judiciary becomes a key instrument for maintaining the integrity of our laws over time. If the status quo stays, so if the House goes Democratic and the Senate stays the same, I think it somewhat depends on what the size of the majorities are, particularly again in the Senate as it relates to judicial appointments, but also in terms of investigations and so forth. I think in the House, if the House becomes Democratic, what you'll see is that the Democrats will have more say over the budget. They'll have a lot of say over what time is spent investigating EPA, what's the EPA freeze on fuel standards, on the shrinkage of national monuments, for example, on Secretary of Interior Zinke's efforts to on conflicts and potential violations of the law, particularly involving allowing his wife to travel everywhere with him at taxpayer expense, the deal he's constructed with Halliburton in Montana. I think looking at the record in terms of favoring coal and oil and gas development in many administrative actions, perhaps investigations on the subversion of climate science in federal agencies. And I also think, most importantly, I hope the Democrats, if they take the House at least, learn a lesson from what happened in 07 when the Democrats got the House and they got the Senate too in the end of the second Bush term, is they really spent some time laying the groundwork for when Obama ended up getting elected in 09, which they developed laws, they developed policies, they tried to move them through Congress knowing that they weren't going to get ultimately enacted, but they really laid the groundwork to hit the ground running in 29, and they could do the same for 2021. If both houses flip, I think there will be a lot of investigations. There'll be a whole different budget scenario. And I think the Senate and the House will be obviously occupied with a lot of other issues besides the environment. But they'll have to be very strategic about what they do on the environment because the president still will have veto power. And so they're going to have to find ways to make it palatable to get bills signed if they want to get stuff done, as opposed to just making a statement. Now, if I could turn to California for just a few minutes and then spark some conversation with Mary and Mike on that, I have no idea, actually, what if John Cox is elected, what he will do. There's no environmental record. He's not made any pronouncements on the environment except to favor the repeal of the transportation tax, which has enormous consequences for the environment. And even on a small level, but important level, what was passed by the legislature and signed by the governor in this gas tax was $82 million a year to go to parks. And that's really significant money in a parks budget. And that will go away. But I have a feeling that Cox, he will have to deal with an overwhelmingly Democratic legislature in Sacramento.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So there's not much he's going to get done legislatively. There's stuff he could do with his appointments and not follow through on California's commitments to climate change, not follow through on its commitments to the cap and trade expenditures and so forth. But I think he'll have a hard row to go in terms of giving the state of the California legislature. With Gavin Newsom, I think as committed to the environment as Gavin has been and seems to be, I think initially as governor, issues like health care, education, prisons, pension liability overwhelm a governor. And I also think he's talked about this, of doing what he can to maintain California's good financial standing that Jerry Brown has created with a having come into office with a $26 billion deficit. He's managed to create, with legislative approval, basically a fund, a rainy day fund that's now at $14 billion. And everything I read from people who know a lot about the economy say that California is in for a downturn, probably the nation's in for some downturn. So I think Gavin's going to be very mindful of expenditures in terms of looking at across the board, but particularly in terms of the environment. But I do think one of the ways that Gavin's going to get directly involved in the environment, and it could be John Cox too, is in all likelihood in the first year of office, there will be a natural disaster. There will be a drought. There will be a flood. There will be a wildfire. And any governor has to get really deeply involved in that. And that leads you into directions in policy issues on those kinds of matters. And, whether it's a major flood that affects Delta Islands, the below sea level islands, that affects the bay, that affects urban areas, whether there are a drought that requires major cutbacks in water usage, you start to get into environmental policy that way in a serious way. I think another thing to watch is if Proposition 3, as Mike said, is a $9 billion water bond on the ballot, and the polling of it is pretty strong. The governor is going to have enormous discretion over, there are pots of that money, but it's the way it's written, it's continuously appropriated. So the California legislature really has no role in that. And you're going to have agencies, depending on how they let the money out, that don't have a lot of capacity for that kind of money. Plus the passage of Prop 68, which Mary and I worked on in June, which was a $4 billion bond, you're going to have agencies just flowing in money. And so how to give it out strategically, how to give it out well, how to give it out with accountability for outcomes will be a major task right off the bat for any incoming governor. I think another major issue that's going to come up pretty quickly has to do with the cap and trade revenues and whether a governor continues Governor Brown's support for $450 million of that a year going to high-speed rail. And that's a lot of money that off that pot that if a governor legislature wants to change, you can direct that to lots of other kinds of environmentally related issues. Another issue that a governor and the legislature is going to have to face at some point that will be made even more severe if there's a drought or a flood is the reality that there is 1 million people in California without access to clean, safe drinking water. It's 10 times what went on in Flint, Michigan. It's really scandalous. And it all has to do largely with money. And so the willingness to develop funding sources and to work with regional and local water districts and local levels to provide enough money to operate water systems and upgrade them to the point where the people have access to, and these are largely Latino communities. Some of it exists in LA and areas like San Diego and Riverside, but the majority of which is in the San Joaquin Valley. It just cannot continue, and I think there'll be a lot of pressure on any governor and the legislature to deal with it. I think that another issue that is going to come up in one way or another is as it relates to these disasters and where Gavin Newsom particularly could find a way to make his mark, because I think he's going to continue and try to further Jerry Brown's efforts on climate mitigation, is climate resiliency. Is that there is money available in Prop 68, $450 million to deal with sea level rise and climate resiliency. There's money in San Francisco Bay, a lot of money, to deal with restoration and sea level rise in San Francisco Bay. Coastal communities are starting to spend millions of dollars on sea level rise issues. Wildfire needs a really much more sensible set of policies to deal with longer term. They're going to continue to exist. So do you do more prescribed burns, which creates more air quality issues? Do you do more thinning of dead trees? How do you deal with local economies that are in decline in a lot of these rural communities and having to deal with wildfire? Increasing wildfire impacts in urban areas, such as in Napa, Sonoma, Santa Barbara, that have really, as many things, have a disproportionate impact on communities of color and poorer communities. So I think those are some of the issues that are going to have to be really thought through rather quickly, in addition to some of the major issues facing this state.
Well, thank you, Michael. We want to take your questions, and I know Ann has been coming around with the question cards. Apologies for having to do it that way, but it's because this may be broadcast and we need those read into the record. Let me exercise, while Ann is collecting those cards, let me exercise the moderator's privilege of asking the first question of Michael, because, you know, what he said about the Republican genesis of the whole conservation movement is very true. Theodore Roosevelt was a Republican, responsible for more national monuments and the beginnings of the National Wildlife Refuge System. When the joke in Washington, though, Michael, is when Secretary Zinke came into office, he promised to build on Theodore Roosevelt's legacy. And he carried that out. He built oil wells and so forth on all over Theodore Roosevelt's legacy. So are the days of the Theodore Roosevelt Republicans really dead, or is in this partisan, hyper-partisan environment, or do we have a chance to bring that back? Are we going to see the pendulum swing back to a more bipartisan approach to these issues, like you and I experienced when we were in D.C.?
You've just listened to Michael Sutton, Executive Director, Goldman Environmental Foundation, who's our moderator, and he's addressed that question to Michael Mantell, President, Resources Legal Fund. And would you like Mary to also comment?
Absolutely.
So, look, you know, we exist in this work as optimists. We're all about change, and I do think it's a long-term effort. I don't think that's going to happen overnight in terms of finding Republican champions on these issues. I do see some greater recognition that, for example, that climate change is real, that this effort to deny it is not succeeding. It's becoming more and more obvious, and business people are looking at this in terms of their long-term, what it means long-term for their business. So I'm hoping even on that issue that over time it becomes one of what's the best way to address it, as opposed to saying it doesn't exist. But as I said, I do think that the effort has to be, and this is where philanthropy has a major role to play, but I think all of us do, is to work more closely at the local level, to bringing people around on these issues, to making them understand how it affects them in their daily lives. I think I have a lot of hope in the younger generation. Millennials, communities of color, of all stripes, really, the polling shows they care deeply about these issues. And so I think it's, you know, in rural communities, particularly in California really is two states. If you look at any voting map on these ballot measures on a single plastic bag ban in 2016, I'm sorry, it's all the blue is on the coast and all the red is in the interior, with the exception of a few places. And so even in California, we have a lot of work to do at the ground level in terms of bringing people around and finding new champions and leaders, whatever party they are in.
Just to jump in here quickly, I think there's two things I'm really interested in. One is what happens, and I mentioned this earlier, in these battleground districts that have typically been red and more conservative, that now really aren't red or blue, and that they're a little bit up for grabs. And I think the ones I'm particularly interested in are the ones that have incumbents who have rock star challengers to them, because I think what we're seeing is, I think my hope is we'll win some of them. We may not win all of them, but I think what we are seeing is that these candidates are doing two things. They are changing the hearts and minds of their district. They are speaking directly to current issues that the incumbents have not been. I think we're seeing a lot of, you know, take McClintock's district, for example, that's been ravaged with wildfires, who's doubling down on the politics of pollution. And then he has a challenger, young woman, who is really talking to the issues of the community in terms of how they've been impacted by wildfires and what's real to them. And so I'm really interested to see how these changes specifically, what comes out of these campaigns, not just in terms of whether they are able to flip the seats, but also very specifically in terms of what happens in those with that electorate in those districts. And are these messages really resonating with them? The other thing that I'm really interested in, and I think we have a moment, so I think quickly the dynamic around some of this work will change, is that, you know, forever we've talked about climate change as something of the future, right? Something that's to come. We have to invest now or else we're going to regret it later. Well, we're in the moment. It's happening now. It's happening year round. It's happening in California. It's happening at home, and it's happening every day on the TV and on people's kind of whatever stream on their phone they get their news. This is the moment we're in, and it's quickly going to become a situation where we are doing investments just to survive, let alone think about how to prepare for the future. And to that point, I did want to speak a little bit on what we can expect from the state level, because there's a couple of things that are really important. On the ballot, we have two initiatives that could really change the way we think about public financing in our state, Props 5 and 6. If those two propositions pass, it is going to really impact funding streams at the local and regional level for cities and counties. Prop 6 will also impact our political dynamics in Sacramento and how we fund some of our work. Passing that, you know, the gas tax, right, was a huge feat. And we've had Senator Josh Newman recalled as a result. And now we have this measure that could roll all of that back. And it will have significant implications for how we finance this important work in California. But it also will have significant implications for the political will in Sacramento to do this. And I think we're at a moment where, you know, everybody I talk to from other states with other leagues talk about, well, you have all those Dems in California. You have all the folks who know are not afraid to say the words climate change. But the truth is, when you think about, you know, either way, after November, the Democrats are either going to have a majority or supermajority in California. That's the reality in the legislature. But I think we're at a place where the Dems are also very conservative. Our Dems are Republicans and Dems. They're not just Dems, right? In other states, they would be Republicans. And so we deal with some of the same things in getting to those majorities. And we're in a place where after November, our two biggest climate change champions and probably, you know, the biggest we've ever had in the state of California are gone. And I mean, you know, Governor Brown, love him or hate him, he didn't do it all right. But climate change was his top issue. Senator Kevin De Leon, who was pro tem for a while, climate change also his top issue. Senator Pavley, trailblazer for us on climate change issues, she is gone. And I think potentially, hopefully, our next governor, Gavin Newsom, is absolutely an environmentalist, but climate change is not his top issue. And I think what's going to be really important is who he puts around him to help him spend all of this money, but also who he puts around him to help him implement some of the biggest, most aggressive climate and environmental policies, which is SB 100 and the executive order that Governor Brown signed to get California carbon neutral by 2045. The implementation of those, passing them was just the inch there, right? The implementation is going to be so critical. How we do it in a way that transitions our state, I mean, it's going to impact everything. It's going to impact our infrastructure. It's going to impact our economy. There's going to be nothing in the state that getting to those targets does not impact. And also, it can either increase disparities in our state or it could help address inequality, historic inequality in our state. That is up for grabs. There is a real chance that this could be one and the same and increase the disparities that we've seen in our state for low-income communities, communities of color, and vulnerable populations. Also, the spending of all this money to do adaptation address water and green infrastructure issues is going to be extremely important. So I think we're at a moment where even though we're all looking nationally, there is so much that could happen in California, both in terms of the impact to how we finance this large-scale work in our state and really puts a lot of that at risk, but also in terms of what we can expect from our legislature and our governor. The good news is that we have seen in the last 2 years, and I think this will continue, that our legislature has become more united against Trump. And so more willing to do bigger, bolder things together. And you've seen a little less infighting, not completely less infighting, but a little less infighting between the Senate and the Assembly and the different groups. So I think we're going to continue to see some movement and some desire to kind of continue to fight back against the attacks that we're seeing in D.C. that are impacting us in California. So some unity on that. But I also think there's some big questions, both in terms of our next governor, how much of a priority this would be, who's going to be around him to help do some of this big implementation and spending money, and then also thinking about these propositions that could have a clear verdict for us on how we finance this work.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is What Do Midterm Elections Mean for the Environment in California and the Nation? And I'd like to start with Michael Sutton, who's been our moderator, and ask him a question. What unique role can the Bay Area play as a national leader on climate adaptation?
Well, I'd throw that question out to the panel. But there is no doubt, following on Mary's comments a moment ago, that California's leadership on environment is more important than ever. We've seen this pendulum swing before, where you lack national leadership on the environment, California picks up the baton and carries it on and does even better. It shows the way for other states. California gave us airbags and seatbelts, for heaven's sake, and certainly has given us leadership on the environment, showed the way for so many other states. The Bay Area itself is the ground zero for that leadership. A couple of years ago, thanks to Michael and Mary's work, the Bay Area passed, Proposition AA, to raise money through essentially a parcel tax, if I recall, that would help pay for climate resilience and the consequences of sea level rise. That's Bay Area communities taxing themselves to help pay for environmental leadership. And I think we're going to see more of that in the Bay Area in the future.
Yeah. I do think we need to expect some leadership from the Bay Area on this. What I would say is that we've seen in the past few years, there's been a lot of competition between the Bay Area and Southern California in terms of resources, in terms of power. I think we're in a moment where there's a lot of political power in Sacramento that's coming from Southern California. And that's really the center that we've seen in the last couple of years in terms of the Senate and the Assembly. But I think we really do have to get to a place where we are thinking the Bay Area is kind of getting organized as a whole for the needs in the Bay Area. I think we've seen that a lot in Southern California, and I think there's a need for the Bay Area really to kind of say, look, we as a geography are extremely vulnerable in this moment. And so we have to have that be part of the bigger picture for the state. And I think we've seen some of that in Southern California around the LA River. And we have our legislators who've gotten really kind of coalesced around a goal of really revitalizing and restoring the LA River for environmental reasons, equity reasons, a bunch of reasons. I think we've got to have that here too. The other thing I would say is that There have been moments where critical environmental policies and opportunities have been put at risk because of the Northern California, Southern California divide. And we can't have that. And we can't let that be the case. A lot of kind of measuring of investments and what does that look like? And I think that's an issue. And we've got to make sure that doesn't become the case. The other thing I would say is that, and I said this a little earlier, but if we are not able to flip some of these important seats in our state, if we are not able to move some of what we've got to move here in California, that's going to be a verdict on, you know, that's our first test, right? The resistance, #resist, it's all this movement. If we can't do it on November 6th, the big question is going to be, what will it take? We all believe it's hitting the fan right now, right? Everything is. And the big question is, in folks in these districts, in rural areas and in purple districts, do they believe everything's hitting the fan right now? And if they don't, why not? And we've got to kind of dig into that and do a better job of not handing out, you know, the facts and the data, but actually speaking to the reality of where we are with these issues. Because we don't have, I mean, ask any expert, we've got 30 years to try to address climate change. That's it. I mean, there's no time. We do not have the time to kind of, you know, incremental change, right? We're all about incremental change. We don't have that moment. It's got to be large scale and it's got to be immediate, else it will not be enough.
Michael Mantell, who's president of Resources Legal Fund, this is a question that was directed to you. Agreed that we need to make environmental issues, Republican bipartisan issues again, but how? Where do we begin, and what do we do? So there's someone in that audience who wants an answer to that very complicated question.
So let me first start with the Bay. I am incredibly hopeful and so proud of what's going on in the Bay because of the passage of Measure AA, plus $20 million out of Prop 68. There's $200 million in Prop 3 for it. Dianne Feinstein led efforts with Anna Eshoo to get $175 million of federal money for restoration in the Bay. The Bay is at a moment in time where it can really get ahead, and it's united. The nine counties voted 73% for this to get ahead of the likelihood of sea level rise implications and adaptation needs, and it's just really important for that money now to be well spent. In terms of how do you bring back sort of more bipartisan leadership and collaboration on these issues? Look, the leaders follow their voters. So we've got to find ways to energize voters in Republican areas to care more about these issues and make it known to their elected officials that these issues matter to them and they're out of step. It's not, as I said, it's not going to happen overnight, but a 10-year concerted effort in a very targeted way to build those bridges, to develop new leaders in those communities, to find solutions to problems that matter to people are all the ingredients that are going to end up changing the dynamic that currently exists.
We have a couple of more questions, and Michael Sutton, I'll come back to you. Michael is executive director of the Goldman Environmental Foundation and our moderator. There is a prediction we heard that national disasters for California will happen in the next few years. Can you comment on that, or what do you want to address about that?
My brother works for the U.S. Forest Service and has spent his entire career in wildland fire. He used to have time off during the year. There used to be a fire season that stretched about from August through October. Nowadays, he says he's rather senior in the agency. He's about to retire. And, you know, when people are about to retire, their level of candor tends to go up. And he said they're going to have to change the name of the agency to the Forest Fire Service because more than half of the agency budget is now devoted to wildland firefighting. And there's no longer a fire season. It's 24/7, 365 days a year now. So there is no doubt that what Michael Mantell said about the increasing incidence of natural disasters like wildfires, like droughts, like floods, and so forth is upon us. We're living it today, and we've seen that in our communities. And so the incoming administration is going to have to deal with this. And they're not going to lack money. This is something that both Michael and Mary have said. Gavin Newsom or John Cox is going to have Prop 68 money, Prop 3 money, if that ballot measure passes. They're going to have marijuana tax revenue because, remember, 20% of the tax revenue on legal marijuana goes to the environment. They're going to have cap and trade money available, money from the ballot measures in the past. We are not going to have no money to do things. And so I think our challenge is to tee up appropriately ambitious things for the next governor to do. And shame on us as a community if we fail to do that. What do you all think?
You know, I'm just going to zero in on something you mentioned. Because of our year-round wildfire season, I think our state has to rethink how it's putting its investments into our forests. And what I mean by that is right now Cal Fire is the agency that is tasked with both kind of conservation and adaptation efforts, as well as forest fire fighting efforts. And they've come to a place where, again, it's year-round, almost all resources. It's got to be their full focus to do that. And so it means the actual adaptation and conservation side is not getting the investment, the intention, the strategy, the innovation it needs for our state. Because what we need to be doing is not just focusing on how do we How do we, you know, put out forest fires, but how do we adapt our forests and our landscapes for what we know is the new normal in California in terms of the climate and the environment for forest fires? And we have not yet, I mean, we have some money on hand. There's a big task force that happened at the end of legislature on this. But I think we actually need a structural change at the state level on who is responsible for that, and having the same agency and the same staff and the same team responsible for both of those means that the urgent need of putting out forest fires, which is absolutely urgent, means that the important work of preparing for the future is not happening at the rate and the need it should be. So I would just say I think that's going to be really important, because we are going to see more and more. Climate change is here, right? It's happening, and that's going to be important for the state to figure out.
There's another question that came in that I thought was very interesting. It's drinking water. Talk about the dangers. And I'm going to coordinate that with another one that says, what are the opportunities do you see for the state to show similar leadership on land and water conservation? So, Michael Mantel, let's start with you, and then we will work back to our moderator to each comment.
Well, if I understand the question, so on safe drinking water, it really is a matter of funding. And right now, the state does have money in bond acts for safe, clean drinking water. The problem is that money can only be used for capital projects. So that's to build the facilities. But it's up to the local and regional entities to operate those facilities and to upgrade them and to use money to staff them. And they can't use the state bond money for that. And because of the restrictions, the constraints that exist on local funding measures requiring a two-thirds vote, it's very hard in many of these communities to get the two-thirds votes. So either there's a possibility of developing funding sources led by citizen initiative that can pass by majority vote because of a change that happened out of a Supreme Court ruling in California. But the other is to reach a deal among ag interests, among environmental justice groups, among urban water agencies, to figure out a new path by which to fund the needed infrastructure and to staff it and maintain and operate it so people have access to clean, safe drinking water. In terms of land, your other question, Anne, on land and water conservation, there's a lot of money in these bond measures for those efforts. There was a time when Governor Brown really tightened urban water conservation standards. That as we had more rain, that was loosened up. That needs to be probably the next governor and legislature need to retighten that up, because we've shown, Californians have shown that they can actually do a lot more to conserve water. So I'll just leave it. There's a lot more to talk about, but I want to let other panelists comment on that.
Mary?
Yeah, thank you. So a lot was said on safe drinking water, but what I would say is there has been a bill that has floated through the Assembly and the Senate in the last 2 years, and it's been led by our EJ partners, who are doing amazing work to make sure to ensure safe drinking water for all Californians. And unfortunately, we did not have the political will to even take it up in the Assembly this year. And that's extremely unfortunate, because as was mentioned, you know, there's almost nothing more important than making sure everybody in California has access to clean drinking water. And as much as we want to have a level of outrage around issues, you know, whatever we see happening across the country, it's happening here in our backyard. The other thing I would say, just in terms of kind of land and water conservation, is that the state has put a large emphasis on mitigation efforts, on climate mitigation efforts, through transportation, through other things. And yet, the sliver of investment that goes to conservation and to natural resources, to adaptation, to sequestration, is embarrassing compared to what's actually needed and the bang for the buck that gets that comes out of those investments. The adaptation conservation is the only sector that does adaptation, mitigation, and sequestration. Right? The like triple prizes investment. And the Legislative Analyst Office, as they did a report analyzing all of the climate investments in the state, they said that the natural resource investments are the biggest bang for the buck. The state gets the most benefit, dollar per dollar from natural resource investments from a climate perspective than any other sector the state is investing in for climate change, to address climate change. And yet it is the smallest pot of funding out of our climate investments. And I think, you know, I'm sure all of us have had conversations on this stage with the hopefully future next governor about this, but that is something that I'm really hoping that this next governor changes in his scope and his plan for addressing climate change, that he really does double down on adaptation and investing in how do we prepare for the future? How do we transform our infrastructure so that it's not hurting us anymore, right? All of our infrastructure was built in a time where we weren't thinking ahead. We didn't know, and we have infrastructure that hurts us. And we really have to fix that. And so I'm hopeful for that with the next governor.
Unfortunately, we have reached that point in our program for our last question, and that's with Michael Sutton. Michael, what would you like to say as we wound up our discussion tonight?
Well, we talked about a lot of issues. We've talked about the real opportunity that exists for major change at the national level, but also for California to continue to lead the way. Fifth largest economy in the world, one of the most progressive states in the United States. It is our responsibility to lead on these environmental issues, and we will. How many of you came to the Goldman Prize ceremonies this last spring here in San Francisco at the Opera House? Our 2018 prize winner for North America was Leanne Walters, and she was the mom, the local resident in Flint, Michigan, who blew open the Flint water crisis. Both of her children suffered lead poisoning. She engineered a citizen science project to find out what was wrong with their drinking water, and then took on the state and the county governments to fix it. I traveled with her in Europe recently, and the biggest question people had for her was, how can this happen in the United States? This is what we're used to in the developing world, where there's no infrastructure, there are no controls, but you have governments. This is the most developed country in the world, the wealthiest country in the world. Why are you having problems with drinking water quality in the United States? We shouldn't be, and we especially shouldn't be in California. And especially with the resources available to our next governor. So I think Mary and Michael are exactly right. We have to get this one right. I don't know if you've ever seen the results of lead poisoning in a human being, but it's not pretty. It is the most toxic substance on the face of the earth to humans and any other wildlife as well. So we have to get this one right. We have to get a lot of things right. And I'm with Mary. I'm very hopeful that our next governor, our legislature, and whoever's in control in Washington will get it right and needs to stand up for what is right with respect to the environment.
Our program tonight is What Do Midterm Elections Mean for the Environment in California and the Nation? And we've had a wonderful panel, so let's have a big applause for our speakers. Really a very comprehensive and interesting presentation, and thank you. Michael Mantel, President, Resources Legal Fund, Mary Kreisman, Chief Executive Officer, California League of Conservation Voters, Michael Sutton, Executive Director, Goldman Environmental Foundation, and our moderator. Thank you, Michael, for being our moderator. Thanks to all our panel for being here. And a big applause and thanks to our terrific audience here. So everyone give us a big applause on the radio and the internet. You can find our programs at www.commonwealthclub.org. Click on commonwealthclub.org for Watch Plus Listen, for programs, audio, videotapes, radio schedules, free weekly podcasts, and archives. And look on our green sheet for our last fall 2018 programs. We have our famous celebration of the wine harvest on November 15th. So come, and we have tasting afterwards. And then on Thursday, December 6th, we have Michael Reynolds, Park Superintendent, Yosemite National Forest, Scott Tannenberg, Deputy Forest Supervisor, Stanislaus National Forest. The program is Heroic Save and Reconstruction, Fires, Forests, Trees, and Homes. Join us on December 6th because this is a very important program. This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Thank you for being here tonight at the Commonwealth Club and our beautiful building at 110 Embarcadero. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.